This hour's top stories. The U.S. rejects a plea by U.N. officials to reverse a decision to blacklist Yemen's Ansarullah movement. The U.S. imposes new sanctions on Chinese officials and firms over tensions in the South China Sea. Also in the headlines this hour, a rehearsal of U.S. President-elect Joe Biden's inauguration is reportedly postponed because of security concerns. Welcome to the program. Our top story this hour, the U.S. has rejected a plea by U.N. officials to reverse a decision to declare Yemen's Ansarullah movement a terrorist group. The U.S. deputy ambassador to the U.N. said the designation would help move forward the political process to settle the Yemen conflict. Richard Mills was addressing a U.N. Security Council briefing that saw fierce criticism of the U.S. decision. On Sunday, Washington blacklisted the Ansarullah movement, which controls northern Yemen. U.N. officials have opposed the designation, citing humanitarian impact and dire consequences for the peace process in Yemen.
I am extremely concerned about the impact of the decision from the United States to designate Ansarullah as a foreign terrorist organization. We fear, in my mission, that there will be inevitably a chilling effect on my efforts to bring the parties together.
We are struggling now without the designation. With the designation, it's going to be catastrophic. It literally is going to be a death sentence to hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of innocent people in Yemen.
Many of you will recall.
UN humanitarian chief Mark Lowcock also urged Washington to reverse its decision. He said Ansarullah's designation could cause a famine not seen in the past four decades. The European Union also criticized the U.S., saying the designation could hinder aid deliveries to Yemen. The country has been devastated by the Saudi-led war that began in 2015. The UN has described Yemen the world's worst humanitarian crisis. Ansarullah and its allied army units are fighting Riyadh that is backed by Washington. International lawyer Edward Corrigan says the U.S. decision to blacklist Ansarullah would be another disaster for millions of people in Yemen.
A lot of commentators look at the Hutus, and they're based in Sana'a, as the real government, and then the Saudis and UAE and their allies are in the south. You know, but they're fractured too. The Saudis support one faction, the UAE supports another faction. There is Al-Qaeda elements. There are, people that are tied with the Yemeni government, but that's a confusing mess. But this is clearly a disaster to say that they're a terrorist group and then to impose all sorts of sanctions. The European Union, European countries are opposed to this. You also have the United Nations speaking out strongly against it.
Right.
And again, it's the poor people of Yemen, they're going to suffer the consequences. They're going to be starved into submission. The only tool the Trump administration has is a sledgehammer, and they just want to smash their opponents.
The Yemeni port of Hodeidah has been forcibly closed by the Saudi-led coalition since the start of the war on Yemen. The closure has caused thousands of workers to lose their jobs and source of income, further exacerbating Yemenis' suffering, our correspondent in Hodeidah reports.
The port of Hodeidah, which is the only outlet to the outside world for millions of Yemenis, is still suffering from a forced closure imposed by the Saudi-led coalition. This has caused thousands of workers to lose their jobs, increasing the rate of poverty and unemployment in the coastal governorate.
The workers at the port of Hodeida include 3,500 workers in the port and 500 others in other fields of the port. The eSupport family and the closure of the port has eliminated the source of income of these people. The suspension of operations of the port has affected the lives of all Yemenis who depend on the port for the arrival of food and medicine.
This port is the only outlet for millions of Yemenis to receive essential supplies, and its continued closure means they can't easily have access to adequate food and medicine, not to mention the large economic losses for the Yemeni economy, estimated at over $1 billion.
The port of Hodeida is one of the important ports in the Red Sea, and direct and indirect corporate losses are estimated at $1.24 billion in total. This is a large sum, since the Red Sea Ports Corporation is responsible for 70% of the imports sent to the 20 governorates for more than 20 million Yemenis.
Yemen has been suffering from a sea and air blockade since the Saudi-led coalition launched its war in March 2015, which has destroyed the country's infrastructure, killed tens of thousands of civilians and starved millions of women and their children. As the Saudi war on Yemen approaches its seventh year, Yemeni's calls for the demilitarization of Port of Hodeida continue to be ignored by the United Nations and other relevant international organizations. From Port of Hodeida, Abdul Latif Al-Washali.
The U.S. has imposed no sanctions on China for alleged misdeeds in the South China Sea. Measures put travel bans on an unspecified number of Chinese officials. They include executives of state-owned enterprises as well as military officials. Nine Chinese firms were also added to a U.S. investment ban that is. Washington has accused the targeted entities of using coercion against states with rival South China Sea claims. Beijing has slammed the move. It has accused Washington of exploiting its state power to crack down on foreign companies. The sanctions are the latest in a series of measures by outgoing President Trump's administrations against China. The measures have escalated tensions between the two sides. To tell us the latest on that developing story, I'm going to bring in Stephen Rebe. He's our man in the capital of Beijing. Who joins us via Skype. Stephen, I'm just going to hand it over to you. Tell us the different aspects of this so far as we've been able to cover that story.
I don't think these sanctions are any surprise to China. As far as China's concerned, America has kicked off a new Cold War. America is out to get it. China is paranoid about America now, trying to stop its economic rise. China considers the South China Sea to be its own sovereign territory. The officials here mock American hypocrisy because what's America's backyard? Well, it's the whole of Latin America, isn't it? It's the whole of the Americas. And if America doesn't get its way there, it just overthrows governments or invades countries. So there's absolutely no agreement that America has a moral case here. I think the only thing that China is concerned about now is that America will start trying to do to China what it did to Iran, and that's try and impose its law on third countries. In effect, say it's not just American companies that are going to, or America that's going to boycott or sanction these Chinese companies. We're going to order other countries to do it, and if they don't listen to us, we're going to lock them out of our market, lock them out of our financial system, essentially ban them from the world's financial system, which is dollar-based. And that's why last week China issued this directive from the Ministry of Commerce, in effect saying that it was going to take action if third parties, companies, or governments from third countries started obeying America's orders, because America might start threatening to sanction those companies, as I said, if they don't toe the line. I think that's the only thing that China's concerned about now, but I think it's prepared for these sanctions, and I don't think we can say they were unexpected.
Many, many thanks. That's Stephen Rebe, our man in Beijing, reporting for us on that story. I really appreciate it. North Korea has displayed a submarine-launched ballistic missile at a military parade in the capital, Pyongyang. The missile was showcased as part of celebrations to mark the inauguration of the 8th Congress of the ruling Workers' Party. The parade also included the march of the Republic's elite units and rockets, which North Korean media describe as having powerful striking capabilities for thoroughly annihilating enemies outside the territory. North Korean leader Kim Jong-un addressed the assembly and decried the U.S. as the foremost principal enemy of his country. Now, the Pentagon says far-right and white supremacist extremism in the U.S. military has increased over the past year. An unnamed senior military official said radical groups are actively recruiting U.S. military personnel into their cause. The official added that extremist groups are also encouraging their members to join the armed forces to acquire skills and experience. Active duty service members and veterans, as well as police officers, were among the U.S. president's supporters who stormed the Capitol last week. The Pentagon says it will launch an investigation into the extent of extremism in U.S. military ranks. This after 14 senators called for the, quote, alarming trend to be immediately addressed. Political activist Life Malcolm describes white supremacists as terrorists who have always oppressed black people, not only in the U.S., but also in other parts of the world.
White people have been brilliant at naming and renaming, defining and redefining the reality that most people in the world live in. So there's no such thing as white supremacists, just colonialists and capitalists who've always been about the business of oppressing and exploiting African people and others around the world since they brought us here, since they invaded the shores of Haiti, Jamaica, and other areas of the world, since they stole the land here from the indigenous people, the so-called Mexicans and others. These people aren't supreme in any way, shape, or form or fashion. They're just terrorists, colonists, and capitalists who exploit people all around the world. This idea that the military is recruiting these people is also redefining that the capitalist, that the colonizer has been brilliant at, as I mentioned before. The domestic military, the police, is the breeding ground for the military that goes around the world and takes and spreads this kind of terror and brutality that in the name of so-called white supremacy.
Rehearsal for U.S. President-elect Joe Biden's inauguration has been reportedly postponed because of security concerns. Rehearsal was scheduled for Sunday, but now it is planned for a day later. That's according to two people with knowledge of the decision. Biden's team has also canceled a Washington trip planned for Monday because of heightened security concerns. The U.S. is beefing up security in the capital city and other states ahead of Biden's inauguration on January the 20th. 20,000 National Guards have been deployed to Washington after the FBI warned of a major security threat. All these come in the wake of the breach of Congress by supporters of President Donald Trump last Wednesday. Welcome to This Hour's On the News Line. A prominent Israeli NGO has recently slammed the regime as an apartheid entity pursuing an agenda of Jewish supremacy in the occupied Palestinian territories. The assessment of the Israeli behavior by B'Tselem was published by the British daily The Guardian. Needless to say, the revelations have won the author of the piece no friends in Tel Aviv.
Many people around the world have highly condemned the brutal actions of the Israeli regime against the people of Palestine, whilst others have simply turned a blind eye to the actions of the regime, as it does not suit their foreign policy requirements. But when the criticism comes from within, surely it's time to take heed. In a piece in the UK Daily, The Guardian, Israeli human rights group B'Tselem director Shirai Elad slammed the Israeli regime's treatment of Palestine as apartheid control, which, coming from Israel's largest human rights group and a Jewish author, is something that has rocked Tel Aviv, who have quickly blunted the comments via its embassy spokesman in London, Ohad Zemet. Elad goes on to claim that the Israeli regime is working solely to advance the supremacy of one group of people, namely the Jews, which is most ironic, as the Jewish people themselves claim to have once been victims to such treatment, yet fail to back Elad's allegations when it's they who are at fault. So bad has the situation become, from the controlling of land and sea borders in Gaza to the endless slicing away of land in the West Bank, that Elad claims there's not a single square inch of territory where the notion of equality can be claimed between Palestinians and Jews, suggesting clear favoritism towards the Jewish people. With Israel about to enter its fourth election in just 2 years, the rights and voices of the people of Palestine are being suppressed, mostly through the calculated engineering of power by the Israeli regime against Palestinians, be it through political rights or pure and simple denial of rights. But it seems that the people of Palestine are not simply standing back and allowing the Israeli regime to quietly push them into a corner, with regular voices and demonstrations still taking place, opposing the so-called deal of the century, opposing the destruction of Palestinian homes, and opposing the Israeli regime's ongoing attempts to steal more and more Palestinian land.
Israel is no stranger when it comes to committing crimes against Palestinians, ranging from destruction of their homes to killings and the denial of their rights. All these are enough for the one like B'Tselem to label the regime an apartheid practitioner. The raising of the apartheid behavior of the Israeli regime is no doubt a courageous act by the author. However, the question still remains as to why the international community still fails to allow Israeli actions to go unpunished, essentially encouraging the regime's behavior to continue unopposed.
In spite of the United Nations outlawing the Israeli regime from continuing to destroy Palestinian lands and occupy more Palestinian land in the process, the Israeli regime has brazenly ignored the law, hence both undermining an international organization such as the UN and the rights of the people of Palestine in the process. In fact, since the start of 2020, the Israeli regime has demolished over 700 Palestinian buildings, ranging from homes, schools, medical centers, and community buildings, under the faux pretext of lacking construction permits, which is ironic, as they were all built on Palestinian land, hence raising the question as to just which Israeli regime permit could they possibly need. On top of the destruction of Palestinian homes and buildings, it's also the lives of the people of Palestine that the Israeli regime feels it so liberally able to take away. In 2020 alone, at least 27 Palestinian civilians were murdered in cold blood by the Israeli regime. Seven were children, proving that the execution of Palestinians is something that the Israeli regime is also getting away with scot-free. So poor and brazen is the behavior of the Israeli regime that now even Jewish settlers are taking things into their own hands, emulating the crimes of their regime by raiding and attacking Palestinians in the occupied West Bank. In fact, in 2020 alone, 248 attacks were committed by settlers, all of which have again gone unpunished and unnoticed across the international community. With the normalization of ties between the Israeli regime and Arab nations such as Bahrain, the UAE, and Morocco, it seems that the voices of opposition are being deafened by the regime's false diplomacy, meaning that the people and land of Palestine is being wiped out by the Israelis, and equally as bad, being forgotten by their Arab brothers and sisters around the region.
Germany's total coronavirus cases have crossed 2 million as the country grapples with the second wave of the pandemic. Germany on Friday registered over 22,000 new COVID cases and over 1,100 fatalities. The country's total death toll is now close to 45,000. Germany has been hit hard by the second wave of the pandemic, despite curbs in place since November. It is currently the 10th most affected country in the world. Chancellor Angela Merkel has now called for further tightening of the restrictions to control the disease. She has also voiced concern about a more contagious variant of COVID, which surfaced in the UK. And that's it with international news.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
هدایتی کنه.
It guides us through life.
همه چیز رو تعلیم داده.
It has taught us everything.
باید آموخت. باید فهمید.
We should learn and appreciate what it gives us.
و اونگاه پیاده کردن این مفاهیم در واقعیت زندگی است.
And try to apply them to our daily lives.
چجوری ممکنه؟
How is it possible?
از راه قرآن.
By means of Quran.
این خوندن قرآن و تلاوت قرآن قدم اول است برادران من. این قدم آخر نیست.
Reading and recitation of the Quran is the first step, brothers, not the last one.
هو الذي أرسل رسوله بالهدى ودين.
It is he who has sent his apostle with the guidance and the religion of truth, that he may make it prevail over all religions, though the polytheists should be averse.
والذي أرسل رسوله بالهدى ودين الحق ليظهره على الدين كله ولو كره المشركون.
تلاوت قرآن با صوت خوش، با آداب که شیوه خاصی دارد، موسیقی خاصی دارد، روش خاصی دارد، اینها چیزهای لازم است.
Recitation of the Quran in nice tones should be performed according to particular methods and tones.
اما این کافی نیست.
But it's not enough.
مشکل بزرگ مسلمانان دنیا دوری از قرآن. دوری از قرآن. از قرآن.
Muslims major problem is losing touch with the Quran. Quran. Quran.
کتاب الله.
Path towards enlightenment.
In the name of God, the All-Compassionate, the All-Merciful. Salam, and welcome to another episode of our weekly series titled Path Towards Enlightenment, which is an endeavor to make you and us familiar with an easy and fluent explanation of God's final scripture to all mankind, the Noble Quran, which was revealed to the last and greatest of all messengers, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. We start from where we left you last week, and here is Ayah 32 of Surah Jathiyah.
وَإِذَا قِيلَ إِنَّ وَعْدَ اللَّهِ حَقٌّ وَالسَّاعَةُ لَا رَيْبَ فِيهَا قُلْتُمْ مَا نَدْرِي مَا السَّاعَةُ إِنَّ ظُنُّ إِلَّا ظَنَّا وَمَا نَحْنُ بِمُسْتَيْقِنِينَ.
And when it was said, Allah's promise is indeed true, and there is no doubt about the hour, you said, we do not know what the hour is. We know nothing beyond conjectures, and we do not possess any certainty.
Thank you.
remember, in our last Friday's episode of this series, while explaining the previous ayah of this surah, we said that despite the earnest endeavors of the prophets, the imams, the saints, the scholars, and the righteous persons, the intransigent sinners, idol worshippers, atheists, and all other disbelievers refused to heed the words of guidance and persisted in their evil ways until death overcame them. As a result, they will be engulfed in torment and punishment on the day of resurrection, which they used to deny with disdain and self-conceit, which means the all-merciful Lord never wrongs anyone. And it is only the sinners and disbelievers who wrong themselves by indulging in evil, despite the ample opportunities for repentance and reform provided by God. The ayah that we recited to you now means to say that the characteristics of the disbelievers include suspicion, while those of the believers include inquiry, follow-up, and attainment of certitude. On the day of resurrection, disbelievers shall be engulfed by the evil consequences of their evil deeds, because whenever the true believers would remind them of the truth of God's promise and the eventuality of the day of judgment, instead of contemplating, they used to dismiss it as a conjecture. They would say with disdain, "What is that? We do not know what the hour is." In other words, if these very disbelievers are told that their house is exposed to fire or flood, they will instantly react and make preparations to avert such a probable danger. But when they are reminded of the day of resurrection and judgment, they do not consider any likelihood for its occurrence. From this ayah, we learn that, number one, the true believers should convey the words of truth to all, so that the argument is sealed and no one has any excuses in this regard. And number two, for the conscientious, even the mention of the day of resurrection is enough to prevent them from committing sins. Let us now listen to ayah 33 of the same surah.
وَبَدَا لَهُمْ سَيِّئَاتُ مَا عَمِلُوا وَحَاقَ بِهِمْ مَا كَانُوا بِهِ يَسْتَهْزِئُونَ.
The evils of what they had done will appear to them, and they will be besieged by what they used to deride. This ayah says that on the day of resurrection, the disbelievers will be handed the record of their deeds and will not be able to deny anything. Their evil deeds shall be made manifest for them on the day of judgment, and they will realize what they used to ridicule has finally engulfed them, and there is no escape from its consequences. From this ayah, we learn the following points. Number one, on the day of resurrection, all our deeds will become manifest for us along with their consequences. And number two, those who mock divine rules and teachings of the prophets will one day face the consequences of their arrogant and evil behavior. Now let us listen to ayah 34 of Surah Jathiyah.
وَقِيلَ الْيَوْمَ نَنْسَاكُمْ كَمَا نَسِيتُمْ لِقَاءَ يَوْمِكُمْ هَذَا وَمَأْوَاكُمُ النَّارُ وَمَا لَكُمْ مِنْ نَاصِرِينَ.
And it will be said, today we will forget you, just as you forgot the encounter of this day of yours. The fire will be your abode, and you will not have any helpers. According to Quranic teachings, forgetfulness resulting from the weak memory of a person is neither a crime nor a sin. therefore not punishable. But if a person feigns forgetfulness or does not pay attention to God's commandments out of arrogance and disdain for divine rules, he or she deserves punishment. For example, some persons deny the occurrence of the day of resurrection and insist upon the wrong belief, while some others, even if they do not deny it, are heedless of it in their daily life and act in a way as if they have forgotten it. Both groups will be punished in proportionate with their deeds, and on the day of resurrection, God will treat them as if he had forgotten them. In other words, they have deprived themselves of divine mercy, and as a result will be cast into hell with no helper to save them. Afflicted by torment, the disbelievers shall be told by the angels in charge of their tormenting that the prophets and their teachings were meant to remind you of the eventuality of such a day, but you used to ridicule their words of guidance. As a result, now you have to bear the consequence of your sins, being left to taste the everlasting torment in hell, without any helper to rescue you. This ayah teaches us that, number one, anyone who ignores the eventuality of the day of resurrection through negligence of divine commandments or feigning forgetfulness out of arrogance will be left to his or her fate in the fires of hell, as if forgotten. And number two, mere belief is not enough and should be coupled with virtuous deeds, since a true believer is always conscious of the day of resurrection and judgment. Now let us listen to ayah 35 of the same surah.
ذلكم بأنكم اتخذتم آيات الله هزوا وغرتكم الحياة الدنيا فاليوم لا يخرجون منها ولا هم يستعتبون.
That is because you took the signs of God in derision and the life of the world had deceived you. So today, they will not be brought out of it, that is hell, nor will they be asked to placate Allah. This ayah means to say persons engrossed in material pursuits and deceived by the pleasures or sorrows of mundane life begin to deride truth and realities, as well as the eventuality of the day of resurrection. As a result, they shall plunge in hell from whose torments they will not find deliverance, nor will be able to justify their excuses for ridiculing divine signs. The disbelievers are thus warned that this is their recompense for the deeds for mocking at the eventuality of the judgment day and the punishment for the sinners, for turning away from the guidance of the prophets with such absurd phrases as, "Who knows of the hereafter? Where is hell? Where is paradise?" This ayah teaches us that, number one, eternal misery in the hereafter is the result of being engrossed in material pursuits and deceived by mundane life. And number two, through the prophets, God Almighty has sealed all argument for mankind so that nobody will be able to raise any excuse on the day of judgment. Now we present you ayahs 36 and 37, which mark the end of Surah Jathiyah.
فَلِلَّهِ الْحَمْدُ رَبِّ السَّمَاوَاتِ وَرَبِّ الْأَرْضِ رَبِّ الْعَالَمِينَ وَلَهُ الْكِبْرِيَاءُ فِي السَّمَاوَاتِ وَالْأَرْضِ وَهُوَ الْعَزِيزُ الْحَكِيمُ صَدَقَ اللَّهُ الْعَلِيُّ الْعَظِيمُ.
So all praise belongs to Allah, the Lord of the heavens and the Lord of the earth, the Lord of all the worlds. To him belongs all supremacy in the heavens and the earth, and he is the Almighty, the All-Wise. These ayahs mean to say that all praise is for the one and only creator of the entire universe and whatever it contains of the heavens, the earth, the innumerable planets, the plants, the animals, the birds, the inanimate things, as well as souls and bodies. Allah Almighty thus has majesty and supremacy over everything in the universe, which the omnipotent sovereign has arranged with perfect order in harmony with the rule of nature, based on infinite wisdom. This means we human beings are duty-bound to develop his cognizance in the proper manner and express gratitude for his innumerable bounties. These ayahs teach us the following points. Number one, he who has created the universe, including the earth and its wonders of nature, deserves the highest praise. Number two, the entire creation reflects the majesty, power, and wisdom of the one and only Creator. And number three, the proper cognition of God prevents us from disbelief and sins and leads to obedience and the correct form of worship. Well, dear listeners, inshallah, next week, we will take up explanation of the next surah in the serial order, that is, Ahqaf. God bless you and goodbye.
The debate.
The U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo is to designate Yemen's Ansarullah movement as a foreign terrorist organization. The warning, this would exacerbate the humanitarian situation in the country, suffering from all kinds of diseases like malnutrition and famine. Now, in this edition of the debate, we will ask, what is this world coming to when the ones that are being bombed are being sanctioned, while the ones doing the bombing and the killing can go scot-free and get a green pass to continue the siege and the killing.
Saudi Arabia and its allies, backed by the United States, launched a devastating war against Yemen in March 2015 to oust the Ansarullah movement, which took power following the resignation of the country's former president, Abdul Rabbu Mansour Hadi. The conflict that has so far killed tens of thousands of Yemenis, mostly women and children, has been described by the United Nations as the world's worst humanitarian crisis. Nonetheless, in defiance of calls to help end the war, the administration of U.S. President Donald Trump has decided to blacklist the Ansarullah movement. The Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, said the designation will take place on January 19th, the day before President-elect Joe Biden takes office. In a statement, Pompeo accused the movement of terrorist acts, destabilizing the region and obstructing a peaceful solution to the conflict in Yemen. The allegations drew backlash from Yemeni officials.
Taking this decision at this time is the result of great local and international political pressure to stop the war in Yemen. And America is the one that does not want to stop this war and this aggression.
Yemen's Supreme Political Council also branded the United States as a source of terrorism and vowed to respond to its designation move. Iran also condemned the U.S. for branding Ansarullah a terrorist entity.
It's likely the bankrupt U.S. government will do further damage to its reputation in its final days and leave the region with an even more poisonous legacy.
Aid groups also blasted the U.S. blacklisting move, with Oxfam calling the decision a counterproductive and dangerous policy that will put innocent lives at risk. The United States, along with some other Western countries, are major suppliers of weapons to Saudi Arabia. The Trump administration has so far turned a deaf ear to calls from international rights groups and politicians inside the U.S. to halt arms sales to the kingdom. Now the ball is in the court of Joe Biden, who will officially take the helm at the White House on January 20th. It remains to be seen whether he will toe the line of his predecessor towards Yemen or change course.
Our guest joining us for this edition of The Debate, radio host and political commentator Eli Joseph James, joins us from Chicago. We also have journalist and political analyst Elijah McNair, who joins us from Brussels. Gentlemen, welcome. Let me first start with you, Elijah McNair, if I may. We're looking at this sanction that the U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo has announced against the Ansarallah movement, and it does consist of three of its leading leaders. Now, Mike Pompeo, months ago, was advised against not doing this, or the Trump administration, but yet it has chosen this time to do it. Why do you think that is? Why do you think this day was the day that it, or this time is the time that the announcement was made?
Well, the architect of the Saudi war on Yemen is definitely Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, who has failed to develop a comprehensive strategy because he has no military experience or training. He lacks government management and a necessary intelligence to acknowledge that this is a useless war and far from being considered as a victory. He rather engaged in multiple human rights violations and crimes against humanity and gave an incentive for the Houthi to develop their deterrence. Now, it is the U.S. State Department who is responsible for the designation of foreign terrorist organizations. So the Crown Prince pushed Secretary of State Mike Pompeo in his last 8 days, and Pompeo, who visited Riyadh in the last few months, he pushed him to issue a designation against the Houthi, who never attacked Americans, but fought against Al-Qaeda and against the invaders of their countries. And here we're talking about Saudi Arabia and the Emirates. A foreign terrorist organization designation is definitely a political act. So the Trump administration could have made the technical decision to designate the Houthi any time in the last 4 years during the Trump administration. Now, under Biden administration, removing the designation is not that easy. It's a difficult political and bureaucratic process. Now, branding the Houthis as terrorists would be an attempt to block Biden and the world from speaking to the Houthi. The reality is the Houthi control most of northern Yemen, and it's better to hold direct talk with them than to live in a denial and ignore their control and presence in Yemen. Now, having direct contact with the Houthi will establish dialogue, direct talk, exchange of prisoners, halt the attacks on both sides, bring to Sana'a humanitarian support. The Saudis are desperate because the new Biden administration said it will block arms delivery to the kingdom and hold Crown Prince accountable for the Yemen war and all the murders that he did, and in particularly the murder of the journalist Jamal Khashoggi 2 years ago in Istanbul. Even if the new administration doesn't hold Mohammed bin Salman to account, it is likely that there will be a cooperation in the Congress. So designing the Houthis as a foreign terrorist organization, it is definitely going to make it extremely difficult, that already difficult situation on the ground. It will neutralize the effort of humanitarian release organization to get food and medicine to millions of Yemenis.
Let's continue that trend of thought, Eli Joseph James, and ask you, given the fact that the Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, was advised from months ago, and as our guest there from years ago, perhaps, if they wanted to designate the group as a terrorist organization, they may have been told this, that they're going to have a situation humanitarian-wise that's going to get exacerbated. After all, this is the world's largest humanitarian crisis. But given that fact and knowledge that the Secretary of State did have, he still went ahead, or the Trump administration still went ahead with this. Do you think that? Why do you think that is? Why would they do this?
Well, let me say first that President Trump has actually been a relative peacemaker while he's been president. The Democratic Party, with Obama, escalated the war in Afghanistan and Iraq, etc. It's Trump who's pulled out troops and has not made any new wars, which has been unusual for American presidents to not engage us in any new wars. However, given the fact that Biden and Hillary Clinton are cut from the same cloth, I would not expect any promises by Biden to be kept on behalf of Yemen and Houthi, none whatsoever. That's just propaganda he's issuing because he wants to curry favor with anybody who doesn't like Donald Trump, okay? Remember, it was Hillary Clinton who orchestrated the assassination of Gaddafi in Libya, and Biden has always been a supporter of Hillary Clinton, so I would not expect 1 ounce of support from Biden except rhetoric. That's all I would expect from Biden. As to why Mike Pompeo has done this, again, I think it's just posturing by people. I don't think Trump wants to get us involved in yet another conflict, and from my perspective, America has pretty much stayed out of this, except for rattling sabers on behalf of Saudi Arabia and the Israelis. But this, from my perspective, this is Saudi Arabia's war against Yemen. So the Saudis need to be held accountable for invading a sovereign country. I don't know why they did it, but probably at the behest of the Israelis, whose basic policies in the Middle East is to disrupt every other nation except Israel. That's their basic policy. And because the Zionists have so much power here in America, whatever administration we have is pretty much going to do their will.
Okay. The conclusion, Elijah Magnier, that I'm getting from our guest there, Elijah Joseph James, is that the U.S. under President Donald Trump did not engage in a war during his 4 years, and Israel is the one that is interfering or that is somewhat having a hand in all the countries in West Asia, as we call it, or the Middle East. My question would be then, does the U.S. subscribe to provide military equipment via arms sales to countries like Saudi Arabia? Does that make it exempt from not participating in a war like in this case, Yemen, in which, by some accounts, hundreds of thousands have died?
I tend to agree with the half of the answer. So, yes, Israel acted as an advisor to Trump in giving it Syrian Golan Heights, the occupied Syrian Golan Heights, Jerusalem, and Pompeo gave the settlement to Israel. But I fully disagree with your guest when saying Trump did not start a war. Indeed, he has started many wars, because war is not only military, it's also about sanctions. And he starved people in Venezuela, he starved people in Iran, in Syria, in Lebanon. So that is another soft war that is more harmful than a military war. And we saw the war on Iraq, how the Americans defeated Saddam Hussein, but then they couldn't win the war. So they found another way to allow ISIS to occupy the country. So no, Trump also killed General Qasem Soleimani and Abu Mahdi Mohandes. So yes, he made assassinations, and he pushed the whole Middle East to the verge of a very general war that he could start it but not end. On the other hand, in relation to Yemen, the U.S. sold weapons to Saudi Arabia to continue the war on Yemen, and that is a very direct participation to the war crime that the Saudis are committing with U.S. weapons and German and French and the U.K. So there are many participants to this war on Yemen, not directly with many troops on the ground, but there are definitely some U.S. troops guiding the Saudis and offering intelligence, and that is a war that have participated. So it is not right to say the U.S. is not participating to the war on Yemen. It is directly participating to the war, and Trump is responsible for the starvation. That's a soft war on many other countries in the Middle East.
Well, Joseph James, I mean, we can't just skim over. I mean, when I asked you the question, you immediately went and talked about how under Obama, so forth and so on, and Biden is a supporter of Clinton. My question to you was about the humanitarian aspect. We can't skip over this. We're looking at the world's worst humanitarian crisis. This move puts humanitarian access at risk. There are people who are not only dying from now COVID-19, they're dying of starvation, famine, all different sorts of diseases. At the same time, what our guest there from Brussels said, it risks future peace talks between the Ansarola and the opposition. Does the U.S. then want to sabotage, perhaps, any chance of peace by making this type of announcement?
Well, first let me say I can't argue with anything that Elijah just said in terms of boycotts, because, yes, indeed, boycotts are a form of war, right? I was just referring to a military invasion. But, yes, the United States government has been in bed with the Israelis since the Six-Day War. And, in fact, the Israelis attacked one of our ships, the USS Liberty, and that's been downplayed and even totally suppressed. You know, so the Israelis make war on everybody. They make war on everybody. But it's Rothschild banks that run the show in virtually every country in the world, except possibly Iran. I'm not sure if there's any other country that has been resisting the will of the Israeli state and the Zionists who control the world economy. They control the world economy. So if any American president or leader contradicts the will of these Zionists, he's the first one going to be assassinated, as President Kennedy found out. So you can't blame this on the Americans. You have to look at the source. But I think in spite of all that, Trump has been a less aggressive president than anybody else. What I'm trying to say to you and Elijah is expect Biden to be far worse than Trump.
So this leaves us now in a situation where, as you said, Elijah, the Biden administration, I mean, this thing is going to go into effect possibly the 19th of January, a day before President-elect Biden's inauguration. So it's going to leave, kind of pass on the baton to him. What type of approach may we expect from Biden? Will he be proactive, as the news now indicates, for example, today, where key U.S. lawmakers actually urged a quick reversal of this? And I'm going to quote, "The designation of the Ansarullah as a terrorist organization is a death sentence for thousands of Yemenis," coming from Senator Chris Murphy.
Unfortunately, we can no longer trust what the president or president-elect or president candidates are saying. We saw what Obama said before the elections, and we saw what Trump said before the elections, and now we hear what Biden is saying prior to the election. So there are many talks today within the U.S. administration and many talks of the presidential candidates that they change their mind once they are in power. And we see Biden's may have priorities like China, like Russia, like the nuclear deal with Iran, and perhaps Yemen is not on top of his list, as well as the withdrawing from Iraq or from Syria, or leaving Lebanon alone to sort out its own problem. So basically, we can't really trust what Biden is going to do, and we don't have to give a lot of weight to what he said against the Saudis and that he's going to stop the war in Yemen. Definitely, we can come out with the conclusion that Pompeo is doing everything he can to put pressure and to slow down any process the new Biden administration may have things to do in the future to remove all these sanctions, because, I mean, the guy is not stopping. Every single day in the last 20 days, he's coming out with a new sanction. So what Biden is going to do is really unclear, and how much time he needs to undo all these obstacles that Pompeo is putting in front of him, or perhaps benefit from these already imposed sanctions and are in place to say, hey, I didn't do it, that's Trump, and I need time to undo everything. So personally speaking, I cannot trust the Biden administration and say this guy is going to come and make changes. He had the domestic first, he had the relationship with the allies that are spoiled, and then he had China, Russia, etc. So no, I don't think the war on Yemen the criminal and devastating war on Yemen is going to stop in one day or in one month even.
Well, let's try to figure out, Eli Joseph James, what this war is all about. I mean, maybe you can tell us. Do you know what this war is all about?
Well, yes. I'm not sure. All I know is that the Saudis invaded Yemen, right? Not the other way around. And as you said at the very beginning, it's the victims who are being blamed for the crisis when the crisis, when the big bully in the Middle East there is Saudi Arabia. They're the big bully. And as I have stated many times here at Press TV, the Saudis are puppets of the Israelis, and they do the will of the Israelis without question. So, and they're using the Saudis to destabilize the rest of the countries in the Middle East. That's what they're doing, especially Iran. We know what they did to Iraq, but they've pitted Iraq against Iran in a war and elevated Saddam Hussein. Then they stabbed him in the back and made war against him. So this is the only kind of activity you can expect. And unfortunately, our government is so weak vis-a-vis the Zionist power, and of course from the UN, because the UN is just another paper tiger in terms of how they approach these issues. Yeah, okay, so they may condemn the humanitarian crisis in Yemen, but what are they going to do? They're not going to do anything, because the Rothschilds created the UN, the Rothschilds created the Israeli state, and really what needs to happen is the other Middle East countries, when there used to be an oil cartel, or we called an oil cartel, of people against the Rothschild money power, they need to reorganize against that same power and put pressure on them somehow. I don't think that they can organize a war against Iran, although they've been threatening that for the longest time. But the other Arab country, Arab and other countries in the Middle East need to join against this power called the Israeli state. None of this is going to stop until we do that.
Okay, my final question then goes to you in Brussels, Elijah McNair. There are some who have said that if this war was to stop, it could be done with one phone call from the U.S. to Saudi Arabia. Do you think that that is the case, that the U.S. could actually stop this war with one phone call to Saudi Arabia?
I think so, yes, because the Trump revealed many realities during his administration. He said to the Saudis, you would not last for 1 week without my protection. And he said, if you stay for 2 weeks, you will start speaking Farsi. Therefore, when the Americans put pressure on the Saudis to reconcile with Qatar, that was done from one day to another. And Saudi Arabia is just a kingdom that is imposing itself on the Saudis population, because it had the Americans behind it, supporting it. And the Americans, obviously what Trump said, because he said many truths, he doesn't want to lose them. He doesn't want to lose their money. So the day the Americans decide to stop this war, I don't think it will require more than 24 hours. But the Americans are benefiting from this war as long as it lasts and continues. So are the Europeans. So there are many people benefiting from the misery of the Yemeni and the famine that they are going through, and the killing of over 45,000 Yemeni in the useless 6 years of war, just because Yemen and Sana'a decided in 2015 that there will be direct flight between Sana'a and Tehran, and that the Iranians have access to the port of Hodeidah. That's it. The Yemenis are not allowed to have relationship with Iran and decide their faith, and they have to remain as servants to the backyard of the Saudis.
Okay, we're going to end to that. Thank you very much. Let me thank our guest, radio host and political commentator, Eli Joseph James from Chicago, and journalist and political analyst, Elijah McNair. Thank you. Spoke to us from Brussels. That does it for this edition of The Debate. For me, Kaveh Tahweh, and the entire team here in the capital, Tehran, it's goodbye.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Log on to our website,
www.parstoday.com/en.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. The program is Dialogue, and I'm your host, Mahdi. Today we want to talk about one of the great personalities in the early history of the Muslims, Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam. Please stay tuned.